Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast, gathering evidence from the literature. I'm Mike Pratz and I have with me today Jacob Avila. Jacob, can you say hi?
Hello there.
Today we're going to be discussing the paper titled Diagnostic Accuracy of Right Ventricular Dysfunction Markers in Normotensive Emergency Department Patients with Acute Pulmonary Embolism. This was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in September 2016, although you might have seen it earlier because it was e-published in March. So, let me give you some background on this paper. And Jacob, feel free to chime in wherever you feel is important.
Will do.
So, as you may know, patients with pulmonary embolism present to the emergency department kind of often, and it's something that's usually on our differential and definitely on the don't want to miss variety. What this paper did is they want to see how accurate is a goal-directed echo at evaluating RV dysfunction in patients that have a pulmonary embolism. So what they meant by goal-directed is the same as what we mean when we say focused or point of care. It essentially is distinguishing between a provider-operated ultrasound as opposed to an echocardiographer ultrasound that is then read by radiology. Some of their secondary goals in this study were to check out how cardiac biomarkers and CT also helped evaluate RV dysfunction. So they took a prospective consecutive sample of ED patients over 1 year at a single center, and these were patients that were all diagnosed with pulmonary embolism based on a CT angiography or a ventilation perfusion scan that they got. The patients had to be normotensive. They excluded patients that were hypotensive or met the criteria for a massive pulmonary embolism. They had to have evidence on imaging of that PE or a VQ read as high probability, and they had to have had comprehensive echo that could be performed in 24 hours. So the other people that they excluded were people that got the echo and they had inadequate quality. That's always kind of a bummer to see. And they also excluded people that underwent an intervention for PE, such as systemic or catheter-directed thrombolysis or embolectomy, that occurred between their goal-directed echo and their comprehensive echo. All right, you with me so far, Jacob?
I am. One of the things, I mean, it's in their title, so I know they had to do it, but I'm always kind of weary when studies specifically exclude the patients that would benefit from an ultrasound the most, which is the sick patient, the one with the biggest PE, the ones that are hypotensive. But I guess I'll give it to them because they're trying to figure out in a normotensive patient, can you figure out if they have essentially if they have a submassive PE or not? So I'll kind of give it to them. The other thing too that's kind of a bummer is that whole inadequate quality. And I kind of struggle with that as well because in real life, there's going to be a decent percentage of patients where you can't really get an echo image. And I'm sure it happens with you. It happens with me. I'll take my ultrasound transducer there. The patient might even be skinny, you know. We have this thing over here that I call a Tennessee medium and or a one Tennessee unit, which is 100 kilograms. So we might have patients that are like a half Tennessee unit. So they're skinny, but I just can't get good images. And it happens. And part of me feels like they should actually be included in the final kind of analysis because those are all comers. But then part of me says, well, if you can't get an echo image, how can you even put them in there? So I'm okay with it, but definitely something that you have to understand is that in some patients, you're not going to be able to get those echo views. And in that case, you know, unfortunately, ultrasound would be useless. So these guys kind of did it in a good way, I think. And just you have to know it's a limitation kind of right off the bat of who they enrolled.
So as far as who did these ultrasounds, it was for the most part one of five emergency physicians that was trained in this goal-directed echocardiography. One of those was the director of the fellowship and actually a registered diagnostic cardiac sonographer. The other one was a fellow, and then there's three emergency medicine residents. They all got a two-hour lecture and 6 hours of hands-on training by the principal investigator. But ultimately, there was also 13 patients that had the echoes performed by someone else in the emergency department, either a resident physician or an attending emergency physician. So we talked about the design a little bit. This is a prospective study, consecutively enrolled emergency department patients. They calculated test characteristics based on their goal-directed echo. They did a power analysis, checked out. And as far as the intervention, all the patients first got diagnosed with a PE, as we said, either by CT or by ventilation perfusion scanning. They couldn't have the massive PE, so then they underwent a goal-directed echo by the study emergency physician. It was interpreted by the emergency physician, who was blinded, and then they underwent a comprehensive echo interpreted by a cardiologist. They all got a brain natriuretic peptide as well as a troponin to assess for serum markers of RV strain. As far as the scan itself, they took a phased array transducer, and they were looking for any one of three things. Severe RV enlargement, which they used the definition of an RV to LV ratio of greater than or equal to 1 based on visual estimation during diastole. They also noted that if they saw some blunting of the normally narrow RV or a enlarged basal RV diameter, that would count too. But again, no measurements were required. They just looked at it and said, does it look like the RV is at least the size of the LV? That would count. Second thing they looked for was RV systolic dysfunction, which they could, again, visually estimate by looking at the RV free wall, or they could measure a tricuspid annular planar systolic excursion, aka the old TAPSE. And if that was less than 1, then that would count as a check mark in that box, severe RV systolic dysfunction. Thirdly, and something that a lot of you may look for when you're evaluating PEs, interventricular septal flattening. What you're looking for here is the increased pressure on the right side pushing into the left side. So instead of normally bowing into the right, you now get the opposite effect where the right is pushing into the left. So any of those things counted as RV dysfunction, but when you look how they actually measured it, you needed to have the RV enlargement, the first one, or else the other ones didn't matter. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They took that one as a little more important than the other ones. What do you think about that, Jacob?
Well, I think that, I don't know if this is what they were thinking, but if you take the average person that, you know, knows a little bit about ultrasound and can put the probe on the patient, that was the one that's probably the easiest to visually estimate, which is basically, is the right heart bigger than the left heart? And so that other stuff, you know, like measuring TAPSE and stuff, that might be a little intimidating to people. I like that they did that. Is the RV bigger than the LV as kind of the most important marker? I agree. And that's, you know, what I do clinically. So I'm glad that they did that. And I feel like that makes it easy. You know, you take like the average doc who, you know, maybe, you know, they're 15 years out. They didn't really train with ultrasound. You say, hey, just tell me if this thing is bigger than that other thing. They'll probably be okay with doing that.
Yeah, I agree. It makes it a little more user-friendly for people less experienced.
Right.
And ultimately, what they did with those was assign a point value for each of the findings, both with the serum biomarkers and the echo signs. Mm-hmm. And then they were able to give a point value for each scan overall with a likelihood of having RV dysfunction. So we can include that in the show notes. So what did they find? Over 1 year period, they were able to enroll 133 patients that had a pulmonary embolism. Then they ended up excluding a few with hypotension, poor quality images. They actually had to exclude 3 cases with poor quality images. I guess not as bad as it could have been.
Right.
4 that had chronic PEs, 1 refused consent, and 6 people who were unable to receive the comprehensive echo. So they also got included. So at the end of the day, they got 116 patients that they're able to analyze.
I always find it interesting. Like, there's always like people who refuse consent. Like, why do that? Like, hey, can I look at your heart and help advance science? It's not going to be painful. It doesn't cost anything. You're like, nah, I'm good. Like, it just seems so weird. Like, why not just, I don't know. I just find that funny. There's always like 1 or 2 people in these studies that just refuse consent. I wonder why.
Yeah. They're like, no, I just don't have time. I have to wait here for 8 hours in the ED. Right. Out of all the 116 they got, 27 were positive for RV dysfunction on the goal-directed echo, 26 were positive on the comprehensive echo. So when they calculated the test characteristics for how good is goal-directed echo for RV dysfunction, 100% sensitivity, 99% specificity. So that gives you a positive likelihood ratio of 90.
Jeez.
And a negative likelihood ratio of either zero or infinity, depends what you like to do there when your sensitivity is 100.
That's crazy. I mean, those, there is very few things that we do emergency medicine, especially with ultrasound, that we are that good at, you know. And one of the things that I'm sure you'll mention, one of the things that I wonder is, you know, that one, what was it? It was 26 were identified by the cardiologist, right? And then like 27 by the EM physician. So I always wonder, I mean, PEs are a dynamic process, you know? So what if that one guy that showed dysfunction got an echo, you know, 20 hours later? And by then, you know, they'd either, maybe they'd gotten thrombolytics, they'd for sure gotten heparin, but maybe they'd gotten thrombolytics, and maybe, you know, that thing that was blocking the RV from pumping blood forward had partially resolved and had resolved that right heart strain. You know, I wonder if we had done them simultaneously, like done the clinician, you know, the bedside one, and then an hour later done the echo one. I wonder if it should have been 100 for everything.
That would have been really nice. I think they actually mentioned that in the report and said that the comprehensive echo called it a top normal size RV, and they had called it a dilated RV.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be just a very minute difference there.
Gotcha.
So looking at the secondary outcomes, how well did the serum biomarkers fare? Well, BNP, sensitivity of 88, specificity 68, troponin, sensitivity of 62, but a little more specific at 93%. When they looked at their score that they made up with the cardiac biomarkers, it was actually pretty useful because it had a sensitivity of 96%, a specificity 66%. So at least the negative likelihood ratio there was 0.06. When they looked at the CT scan, if they saw signs of a central thrombus, was that helpful? It was a little bit helpful. The likelihood ratios there were positive of 2 and a negative of 0.2. It's not quite, I mean, not nearly as good as the ultrasound that they did.
Right.
And even on CT, they looked for measuring the RV to LV ratio on there as well. And that was 91% sensitive, 79% specific. So again, not quite as good as ultrasound. They did do an inter-observer agreement, and they had a kappa of 0.69. It's pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
They did note, because one of their goals was to say, you know, we can't get echoes every hour of the day at every place that we work. So is that why it's going to be useful for us to be able to learn to do it and see how well these point of care or the goal-directed echoes are? Mm-hmm. And so when they looked back at when all the PEs presented, they said 67 of these were outside of the normal Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. So that's a big chunk of them.
Yeah.
So I think that there were some limitations to this study still. Obviously, just a single center, and the sonologists that they had were pretty well trained. 42% of all of the scans were done by the director who had his RDCS and the fellow who was with him. So those people probably have a little more training and skill than the average sonologist that is going to be using point-of-care ultrasound. I think that they also, like we mentioned, excluded inadequate quality images. It would have been nicer if they did a sort of intention to treat type analysis, where once you're in the echo arm, you kind of get the echo even for better for worse, which now we just know if you can't get the images, I don't know what to do, right?
Right.
They could have also calculated the CT things a little differently. That was one of the limitations they mentioned there, whether the LV to RV ratio on CT was always in end diastole, not clear. I think another thing was that the lack of a patient-centered outcome in this study, and I'll give them, this is the preliminary data, so it's really helpful at this point, but really to a patient, we would be more concerned about, you know, does this patient need an intervention? Is there a morbidity or mortality, or even is there a change in their length of stay as a result of getting the goal-directed echo first? That would have been pretty helpful.
Right. I mean, that's the whole point we do this, right, is to figure out, do these patients need thrombolytics or not? I mean, that's what I think that is most useful for, because, I mean, massive PE get thrombolytics every time. The subsegmental ones never get thrombolytics. But what do you do with those guys in the middle, those guys that have, by definition, a submassive PE? And that would be nice, but it seems like it'd be a very long and cumbersome study to do. So, I mean, if somebody would be able to do that, I would be so freaking happy that I'd have some evidence to give thrombolytics when I want to. But this, I mean, this is a good first step, right? At least showing that we can detect it.
I'm not ungrateful for this study. Yeah. I think it's awesome. We're lucky to have it. So again, I think the take-home points that I took from this were that when you use goal-directed echo in a patient that you know has a PE, it's pretty sensitive for right ventricular dysfunction and mm-hmm. pretty specific too. I mean, in this study, even though they may have some pretty experienced operators, 100% sensitivity, 99% specific.
Yeah, so good numbers.
Compared to the cardiac biomarkers or CT findings looking at RV dysfunction, those were not quite as good as echo. So keep that in mind.
Yeah, there's one other thing that I need to mention. This is just because, you know, I teach residents and medical students. It's that this study didn't differentiate between chronic and acute right heart strain. And I think that that's an important thing. It didn't seem to matter with this patient population, but a lot of my patients have COPD. They all smoke. And so they're all going to have chronic right heart strain. So just kind of keep that in mind. And they mentioned it in the article. If you're not sure if it's chronic or acute, one of the easy things you can do is you take a sub-xiphoid view, you know, so right beneath the xiphoid process there, and then measure the lateral wall or the wall that's closest to the chest wall, the anterior chest wall. And if that's greater than 0.5 centimeters, it's considered hypertrophied, and you'd be more concerned about that being a chronic right heart strain.
That's a great point. In this study, they did try to exclude people that had chronic PEs, but you're right, they didn't exclude anyone that could have had other causes of chronic RV dysfunction there.
Right.
So, great point. All right, well, thanks for listening this time, and hopefully we will talk to you soon.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel,
more ultrasound gel podcast.